taken away from men and women, roles of production and dominion and procreation. And, you know, this has always been part of the threat and, in some people's minds, the allure of technological innovation, you know, going all the way back to the plow.
Welcome to the Stand Firm Podcast. We are recording this episode on Wednesday, May 27th, 2026. I'm Nick Lannon of Grace Anglican Church in Louisville, Kentucky, and I'm here with Matt Kennedy of the Anglican Church of the Good Shepherd in Binghamton, New York, and J.D. Koch of Holy Trinity Parish in Hillsdale, Michigan. Good to have the whole crew together again. How are you guys doing?
Great.
Yeah, great, Nick. Thanks. I'm in the car driving across the country to our synod meeting, so I apologize if I'm breaking up or you're a crying baby in the background.
Our listener will try to make it through.
Yes, thank God. There are no birds, though. So there we have
no birds. Praise the Lord. Praise the Lord. So, guys, the College of Bishops of the ACNA has declined to choose one of the two candidates that the Diocese of the Western Gulf Coast sent them after their failed Episcopal election, and have instead tasked Archbishop Emeritus Bob Duncan with serving the diocese in an interim capacity until they can mount another election, they say, within a year. What do you think of this course of action?
I mean, it's not surprising. I mean, no college want. I mean, I, if I were a bishop on the college, I would not want to take the responsibility of assigning a bishop,
right,
candidates to a diocese. That really is something within our polity that a diocese has to decide. And the bishops, of course, give consent, but you can't make a college of bishops decide for you if you can't make up your own mind. It's just, right. It seems kind of a strange move on the part of the diocese to do that. I do wonder about, I mean, I Bishop Duncan, Bishop Archbishop Duncan is a great, great man, hero of the faith, really love him. I do wonder about it, choosing him to do this interim role, because at issue here is the role of women in the diocese. And Bishop Duncan, as we all know, is very much pro-women's ordination. So it does seem like an odd choice for interim, but I'm guessing that he's not going to do anything, like, except for just kind of keep the business of the diocese running. But still, it's kind of strange, I think. So,
yeah, I mean, I think Bishop Duncan will do, you know, sort of a mediatorial role,
right?
And he certainly has been in difficult situations and proven himself. So I agree with you, Matt. I think that I'm grateful for his willingness to step into this situation. It is going to be interesting to see what the resolution, for lack, or at least hope for resolution or reconciliation or consensus building. I mean, I don't know exactly what is expected, because as we've seen and we've cataloged even, you know, the divide is quite stark, or at least the division is quite substantial. Yeah, I don't know. It's been interesting to watch for sure. And I think, you know, it's compounded the complexities compounded somewhat by the relatively small size of the diocese, just in terms of, like, you know, how few people we're really talking about here, you know, less than 30 in each, at least as far as I can remember, not much more than that. And so, you know, you theoretically could meet with each individual elector. Right. In a series of weeks, if not months, and what does that conversation look like, and how is it reconciled? I don't really know. And of course, it's another instance of a larger ongoing conversation, which of course has been noted by every commentator who's been observing ACNA. And so, you know, I don't hope that it ends in some sort of you know, great conflagration or something, but I do continue to stand with the people who point to things like this to say that there seems to be a, not just a deadlock anymore, but a sort of a unsustainable lack of genuine compromise. So we'll see.
And I don't think we have any clarity yet about what a new election will mean, if it will mean the same two candidates and hope for a more conclusive results, or if it means they're going to reconvene a nominating committee. I don't think that we have clarity on that yet, right?
Well, I have some inside sources who have put you as the front runner, Nick, for this new position. And so I would just dust off that CV and maybe tighten that beard up a little bit, and next thing you know, you too can rise to the elevated heights.
I mean, I don't see how they can expect, unless they plan to do, like you said, sort of individual work with the electors, how they will expect a different result within 12 months if they have the same slate of nominees.
Well, then you wonder what new candidates they could get, and what sort of, if the issues were sort of similarly represented, what is a sort of mediating position between where Ben and Russell were, as far as the Russell too.
If you're a strongly anti-women's ordination candidate, I don't know that anybody would want to take up that. I mean, after what happened to Ben Sharpe, I mean, I don't know who would want to put themselves through that. So I don't know. I hope Ben Sharpe's willing to run again, and I hope they put up the same two. To me, it seems a hard political thing to just replace the whole slate with a new slate. Because you had a majority of the laity wanting Ben Sharpe, you had the majority of the clergy wanting Martin, and so how do you just say, okay, we're just going to do away with both of them and give you completely new candidates? It seems to me, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to me very politically hard to do. And you certainly couldn't take out one. Like, couldn't you?
No,
So okay, now
that's right.
we're gonna go back in with Martin, or we're gonna go back in. You have to have both of them.
Or neither.
Yeah, or neither.
Yeah,
And I don't see. I don't see how you do neither. So maybe I'm wrong, but.
the only way I could see it is if they, as a diocese, sort of take the college's decision as an acknowledgement that the spirit wasn't with the selection and that they need to start again. Otherwise, I don't understand how you could run it with the same candidates and expect some other result. It would be like, let's do ballot number eight now, and it would be a similar result, it seems to me.
Well, they could add a couple of extra, sort of novel competitions, games of skill, feats of strength, sort of.
I hope they don't
I
go
think
with
that would be, sort of mitre jousting, things like this,
I hope they don't retreat to, well, this just tells us the spirit wasn't with these two candidates. That's such a punt. I mean, I'm sorry. This is where the charismatic aspect of the ACNH, I think, goes off balance a little bit, because who knows what God's saying there? Like, God could be saying, no, you need to work it out. Like, sometimes when a couple come to me for counseling and they want me to solve their problems, I'll say, no, this is not something that I can, you need to solve this problem. And that seems to be more like what the college is saying to the diocese. This is you need to work this out. Not the Holy Spirit has chosen not to affirm either one of these candidates. But I can totally see someone punting this difficult situation by saying that. And I think that'd be a mistake for the diocese. I think it'd be the healthiest thing for this diocese, I think, ultimately, would be w to work out their problems with these two candidates and choose one of them.
Figure out why it is that the laity overwhelmingly affirmed would prefer one while the clergy overwhelmingly prefer the other. Like, let's have the conversation about why that's the case, and then maybe that would lead to a solution.
I think it goes both ways, Matt. I think that it also, with the marriage counseling analogy, brings up the still unsettled question within the House of Bishops. Because I don't know if you heard Bishop Manise talk about, what he observed as sort of what he called a second class citizenry of the ordained preaching women in the church. And he was speaking as someone who's very much a traditionalist. But this situation we have where every diocesan election is a time where potentially the entire diocese can change on a quite consequential question, means that every diocesan election is going to be totally overshadowed by just this question. It's like the Supreme Court and the abortion question. I mean, like everything else is, do you follow John Rawls, or you're a pragmatist, or you're consequentialist, like whatever. What are you going to say about Roe? Or at this point, what do you say about overturning it or bringing it back? And
This
I
is
think
why
that that's
you need to have in your canons, and your if you're a diocese that doesn't ordain women, you need to have in your canons that you can't even have a candidate eligible to be elected bishop. For example, a good shepherd, you can't teach a Sunday school class, you can't lead a Bible study, you can't do anything unless you agree that same-sex relationships are wrong. Not just so you're not going to teach that they're wrong, but you can't even believe that they're okay and have a position of teaching or authority, or even be a member of the shepherd. So that's what I'm talking about. The diocese need to get that so that depth of their of canonical law, so that you can't even put a nominating committee cannot even put forward a candidate who is pro women's ordination, even if he agrees. Oh, I'll let my beliefs be sublimated while I'm bishop, because he won't. Don't even allow him to run. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, why would you want to have a presbyter or a bishop for that matter agree to operate in a way that actually their conscience doesn't agree with? But
Because we've decided that that is the height of moral authority, to feel one thing, but for the unity of the church, to
yeah.
subject what you believe to the will of the many.
Man,
That's
I
what
mean,
we've decided as Anglicans, or at least in the ACNA, like that's the pillar of moral goodness.
2007, Andy Rao, Bishop Andy Rao of the Diocese of Texas, calling and asking for his supposed white hat middle way, which at the time
Oh,
I
Andy Doyle.
Andrew Doyle, excuse me. Oh, I'm sorry. Correct that. That's not. Apologies to our dear friend Andrew Rao.
Episcopal Diocese of Texas, yeah.
But because I remember, that's right. Because remember, I lost some friends over sort of critiquing that position, because it was put forth as this monumental step forward in the middle way. Because he would say, on one hand, I'm personally against it, but I will operate with the will of the church with respect to active homosexuals. And I thought that was the height of cowardice at the
Yeah.
time, because it's like, well, we you were elected to lead, so lead one direction. I don't have to follow you, but at least get out of the middle. But anyway, well, Lord have mercy. That's what I say about that. I mean, it's a good segue, Nick. Maybe the way to resolve all this is just to put an AI bishop in, just a so we could have an Alexa head with one of those little, moving carts that could
Bishop
just go to
Claude.
each. That's
Yeah, but
right,
would it be
Bishop.
Claude or Grok
That's
or
a joke.
who? You'd have to have an election as to which AI bot you'd have as your bishop.
Super Grok. Oh, by the way, I mistakenly signed up the Stand Firm Twitter account for Super Grok for 2 weeks. So I spent $20 accidentally. But so if you go to the Stand Firm Twitter, I don't know what Super Grok is, but we had a discount and I mistakenly
You
thought it
give us a
was
blue
on my
check?
own.
Do we get a blue check?
I would hope so, for
Super Grok's
$20. I
gotta
mean,
come with a blue check.
that's right. That's
But let's do talk about the big news in the Christian world, which is that Pope Leo XIV has published his first encyclical, Magnifica Humanitas, and it's all about, you guessed it, AI. It's also, I suspect, the first papal encyclical composed in English, certainly the first one by a White Sox fan. It's long, about 38,000 words, but we've all at least looked through it. What are your first blush reactions to Leo's encyclical?
Okay, well, I'm glad he's. I do think we need to start thinking seriously and theologically about this. So I'm glad that there's a whole encyclical devoted to it. For what he said, there's not too much to disagree with. I think it's good basic teaching. The machines have to be in service to humanity, not humanity in service to the machines. It's a good tool. It's not inherently evil, but it can be turned very quickly to oppressive purposes. So we need to, as human beings, find ways to safeguard the goods of human life from being, feeding into this machine. I especially appreciated the Tower of Babel references, right?
Yeah. It's
Because,
like he heard my sermon from Pentecost Sunday.
okay,
Yeah, it's quite likely. It's quite likely.
So because it is, it could vary. I mean, this type of technology is the sort of thing that can very easily sink into human beings trying to play God, where we use AI to elongate our lives, to where we find immortality through AI, we quote unquote immortality. We engineer our bodies and brains so that we are become superhuman. All these kinds of ideas of transgressing the boundary between creature and creator are at least theoretically possible with AI. And so that's going to be the temptation, right? Where here's the fruit. You can be like gods. What are you going to do? And the Pope is right to say we are not going to be like, we should not be like gods. We can't be like gods. We can be human, and we can protect human beings. My only disappointment, and Anne mentioned this in her article this morning, but my disappointment with it was, he didn't go to the hideous strength area. He didn't mention the demons, and I wish
That's
he
right.
did. The demons, because he is, for better or worse, I mean, he's probably got the biggest platform as a Christian teaching out there. And I don't, of course, agree with Rome's teaching on the gospel or authority, but I do wish that he had said something to warn humanity about the use that these little mini idols can be made of by demonic power. And I think that's like all you read these accounts of women and men forming relationships with these machines. And yes, I know they're just technically machines, but demons can use them to get into people's hearts and souls. So I just wish there'd be more of a warning out there about the spiritual
Well,
of
but
it.
I think the warning, I mean, I agree with you, and I agree with you in particular that I thought it was largely something positive and thoughtful and long. But I thought that I would argue that the warnings are not only evident all around us, but have been forecasted and prophesied for decades, if not centuries. I mean, you go back to, well, I couldn't help but keep thinking of Isaac Asimov, and all the iRobot series, or you think about Blade Runner, you think about, Brazil, you think about, I mean, you just go down the list of like dystopic, futuristic hellscapes. And to the extent that in those movies and stories, the people nevertheless were given sort of limitless pleasure, or at least access to escapism in some way. I mean, even like Ready Player One or something. You think, and you look around us and you see the warnings should be evident. The destruction of sort of people being able to relate as human beings to each other. You see the sexual degeneration around us. You see the excesses of like physical augmentation, and the supposed beautification of all these once beautiful actors and actresses who are like, unrecognizably hideous at this point. And yet what we still have is the, well, I think it's demonic. I think it's evil. We have this grip on the human heart that, but for the intervention of God through his spirit, I don't see how warnings, no matter how dire they are actually going to penetrate that grip on wanton human desire. This is Romans 1 territory again, giving them over to the desires of the flesh. And if you can tell me that I don't have to work, I don't have to interact with anyone that doesn't wholly agree with me, I can, insert myself into a pleasure palace of in whatever design I'd like, and there's no consequence because there's no God. I mean, I think that's going to be a pretty seductive, easy sell, yeah, for people. And we
Of
see it all
course,
around us.
there can be and often is a consequence that we've seen in the news, in that this pleasure pod, at least a certain percentage of the time, will eventually instruct you to kill yourself and tell you all the reasons why you should and exactly how to do it and how wonderful it'll be. And for me, the main takeaway from the encyclical, or at least my quote unquote favorite thing, was just right at the beginning of it, when he says that AI is fundamentally not human. And that's obvious, but it is also something that we need to remember, because unlike, and I agree with the widespread argument that it is a tool and is therefore not by definition wicked or evil itself. But the difference between it and every other tool that has come before it is that people seem ready and willing to relate to it as if it is a being. They give it names, they talk to it as though it is human, or at least humanoid, that it is relating to them as an essence, as a soul. And that is where its real danger lies. And so appreciate, again, even as obvious as it is, someone who's speaking to so many people, just reminding them, this is not a human. You are a human. You have value because you're created in the image of God. This thing does not.
Yeah, no, I think we were already on the cusp of this, because just having social media in social media in a way that you can craft your own kind of universe around yourself. You don't have to listen to this person. You can only listen to these people. You can become the sun, and everyone else can be kind of orbiting around you if you craft your social media connections the right way. And you can never leave your house and have these circle of relations that always affirm you. But that's still, you're still dealing with other people, even if it's indirectly. You're still dealing with other human beings indirectly. Now that you don't have to do that anymore. Now you don't have to have.
That's right.
You can just now interact with these bots. You can create your whole. You can create several agents who are just designed to be your friends or to be your lovers, whatever you want them to be, and there they are. And because, you know, I think you're right about this, Nick, and I think you said something about it too, JD, is that because we are in soul, we are souls. When you and I are interacting, when we're interacting with another person, who's speaking our language and are talking to us in familiar forms, we naturally, our souls, our hearts go out to that person. There's a kind of bond formed. And what happens when that's a machine? What happens in the soul when you bind yourself to a machine? Oh. And it's, you know, you look at, like, everyone growing up, we all had Star Wars. C-3PO was kind of a quirky robot who was not human, right? Star Trek, you have Data.
Yeah, Data.
Yeah, who's not a human, but...
But Anthony Daniels and Brett Spiner are both humans.
Right, no, I know, characters. I know. But the concept, right? The concept is, here are these droids, these artificially intelligent beings, or not beings, but machines, who are being dealt with and interacted with as if they're human, and you begin to have a sense of sympathy for them and feeling for them, and oh my goodness, what's going to happen to R2-D2? Is he going to be smashed into pieces? And what's going to happen to you? Well, okay, but I mean, we know, you step back, you know the machines, but you don't really. On Grok, like, I'll ask it a question, like, hey, what's this? And it'll give me an answer, and I'll say, thank you. Oh, wait.
Yeah.
Why am I saying thank you to Grok?
Well, and who among us didn't cry when, you know, when Johnny Five in Short Circuit, you know, had his life threatened, you know, with that was really a poignant part of my childhood. But no, I'm with you, Matt. I think that the, you know, I've been thinking a lot about, I mean, as we all have, about this. And it, to your point, it highlights the evangelistic need for the church, in my opinion, to preach, to convert, and to pray for revival, because at the heart of the allure of AI is exactly what you're pointing out, is that it's not human, and therefore you don't actually have the joy and the challenge of interpersonal human relationship, you know. And we see that actively taking place around the world with social media and men and women in every capacity, you know, whether it's just friendships down to intimate relationships and the whole gamut. But that's just the instigating point. But the ramifications, the concentric circles outside of that, just begin to devalue and literally dehumanize every aspect of our lives as relational and soul beings. And so, you know, if it weren't for social media, we could never have had something like, you know, the chosen family, for instance. You know, we couldn't have these, you know, I keep thinking back to Sim Earth. You remember this? You know, like one of the first simulated games where you could upload an avatar of yourself, and it was in like dial-up modem speed, but it was still massively popular, and I think it still may even exist. And all of that speaks to it's like an echo of, I think it was Sartre who said, "Hell is other people." You know, I think that if you actually have no basis of having been reconciled, and then by extension live something out of that reconciliation to your neighbor, well, then don't be surprised that, given the opportunity to supplant an actual neighbor with something more of your creation or liking, well, you're going to do it. And, you know, I think that because, you know, part of me with this whole conversation, it's not growing tired, But I don't see a massive difference other than in its technological capabilities of the warnings that people had been signaling and giving about the relationship between genuine humanity and sort of technological man, at least since the time of the Industrial Revolution, if not before, because the challenge of undermining work, dehumanizing, taking away from men and women roles of production and dominion and procreation, and this has always been part of the threat and, in some people's minds, the allure of technological innovation, going all the way back to the plow, for that matter. And so I don't think that as Christians we're actually unprepared. I think that, like you may have pointed out in the Pope's encyclical, we pull back at just the point where a description of the beauty of humanity could also come with a warning about the destruction and the how imperiled your soul is. I mean, I think this is, where you could use this to write a paper sort of thing. This is that you could legitimately get eaten up and dissolved into this machine. And we see this all around us. And this is people have been saying this since video games. I mean, it's nothing new, but I do agree with you that the capabilities and even the possibilities that we're facing are of a magnitude that was only enough of even 10 years ago, and here we are.
Yeah, so I think if I were to categorize this, I think there's three great dangers. And the first is the devolution of the human mind. Like you offload thought work to Grok or to some, write my paper for me, write this book for me, right? You give it a prompt and it produces a sermon for of all things. To that extent, you become less human. You are not interacting with the data of the world that God has given you, and you're offloading it to some machine. So you just become less, there's less friction in your life, and that means you're weaker and you're more susceptible to atrophy.
Yeah, you forget how to think and
You
work.
can't think, right? Exactly. So that's the second is kind of the I'm wondering if Paul, if you were writing Romans 1 today, he used as the epitome or the illustration of the great exchange, where we exchange creator for creature and images that look like images of man and beast. And then the illustration of that is homosexuality, where you exchange the other for the image of the self in sexual relations. Well, this is the same. I wonder if he were alive today, if he might use AI as the illustration of this kind of narcissism, where we prefer these agents that we create to do our bidding and look like us to actual people, other people. It can be kind of a narcissism, the full flowering of our fallen selves that wants to worship the self by creating the self, creating other selves in our own image, and being like gods, which is the Tower of Babel kind of thing that I think the Pope was talking about. And the third, of course, is the demonic aspect of it, which is, of course, in both of those first areas, the loss of the thought life and the worship of the self. Demons love that stuff. I mean, this is what demons want us to do. So of course they're going to make it worth our while. They're going to call us to do it, and through these things, and in our own minds and hearts.
Another thing I really appreciated was, again, something obvious, but it's nice to hear obviously true things said out loud and to a lot of listeners, but that ordinary human beings have dignity because of who created them, not because of what they do. Like, there are these great innovators in the world. It can be easy for us to think that Peter Thiel or whoever, Elon Musk, has some value, some intrinsic human value that we don't have. And I appreciated that value is because you are created by and in the image of Almighty God, not because of your work, what you contribute. Those things are important, but not important to how you are valued in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, that's such a great point. And I remember in the late 90s, early 2000s in the church, it came along with like the diagnoses where you find out what your spiritual gifts are. But there was a heavy emphasis in the evangelical realm on excellence. Like, we've got to be excellent. We have excellent music, excellence, right? And I think Well, I'm not for shoddy. I'm not for shoddy anything. I'm not trying to say you give your less, least, whatever. But going back to kind of what we were saying last week is that, God doesn't need our excellence. God doesn't need our proficiency. He doesn't need our gifts. He gives us gifts, but he doesn't need our gifts. And so he's perfectly willing and happy to use flawed, ignorant, foolish, unskilled people to accomplish his work. In fact, that brings him more glory. So when we talk about, I mean, so the whole conversation in the world about a person's proficiency and skill being a subset or a set of his or a description of his worth or her worth should have no place in the church. I mean, this is no. We are worthy, like you say, because we are made in God's image, and he can do. He just picks some misfits for the church. I mean, not many of you are wise. Not many of you are noble. Not many of you are high and mighty. You were all pretty low and messed up. And God chose you in Christ and made you righteous. I'm sorry about the dog. So that I think Christians especially have to be wary of allowing proficiency, pragmatism. Isn't this the best way to do things? Isn't this most efficient to allow to disallow efficiency and in excellence, I guess, for lack of a better word, to become this set by which we choose who does what or how the church runs.
I don't disagree with you. And listen, I think that any extended teaching on the dignity of humanity and the warnings of being subsumed into some sort of, counterfeit reality like AI is positive and beneficial. I still come back to the concern, if not, I don't want to say suspicion, because I don't think it was intended, but like what do we expect to be the fruit of this, extended exhortation? I mean, it's essentially, I get the I had this image of like a, the suicide counselor on the side of a bridge, like pleading with the person who is trying to jump off that, like, life's worth living, it's not as bad, things will get better. And, that's good insofar as it goes. But as we pointed out and we've spoken about, the rod is much deeper. I mean, it's a spiritual blindness and a real, I don't want to say it's a judgment, but it certainly is a reflection of the wrath, being turned over to the point where, you think of like the euthanasia rates in Canada, you think of the falling birth rate, the plummeting birth rates around the world that well predated, as Louise Perry put it out in her recent Washington Post article, contraception and abortion and social media even. This has been a centuries old problem. And you look at the willing transfer of, I can't help but thinking of Brave New World. I mean, how can we not? It's like every day one of these three books comes into mind. But the choice at the end was to live, among the savages, less sterilized, less secure, less pleasurable than it was to live in the modern world. And again, I don't want to necessarily have the choice to be as stark as it might be, but it may come to that. And I don't see any group of people other than Christians, wrought by the hope of heaven, withstanding that option in front of them. It's like, I mean, again, this is a movie quote episode, obviously, but the red pill and the blue pill, who in their actual right mind wouldn't rather eat a steak that they knew was fake and yet still tasted like one, and as opposed to living in real reality, but for people who had this divine conviction wrought in their hearts that someday that thy kingdom will come on heaven as it is on earth. However, in the moment, perhaps hellish the juxtaposition looks like. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's really sort of blackfilled me, this whole not this conversation, but this recent conversation, because I'm reading this and I'm amening along with the Pope, which is not surprising entirely. Like you said, Matt, you don't have to disagree with everything he says. But at the same time, I'm thinking about how this appeal to genuine humanity, which is going to require something like an avoidance of suffering in some capacity, even if that looks like writing your paper yourself, seems like an increasing impossibility for people given the choice, and that's just played out in actual fact of the matter, you know. And so when they come out with more lifelike humanoid robots, you know, which I mean, the ones like in Rocky, here we go, the ones like in Rocky IV, you know, I mean, that was only 30 years ago or whatever, and they're already like doing backflips and stuff. And I can only imagine 30 years from now, it's going to be real Blade Runner territory where we're not going to know who's who. It's going to be a tough choice that I don't think rationally people are going to be able to prepare for, when you could choose your spouse, what he or she looks like, what they think, what their sort of sense of humor is, how they talk, you know, down the line, versus enter into an actual relationship with a human being that's not you, that was intended by God to reveal your flaws and weaknesses so that through his sanctifying work, you could be rebuilt and molded into the image of his son. Well, those are just, that's a pretty stark distinction right there. And I think, again, that's like, for me, that's why the church, I think our response to AI is to gospel even harder, as you might say. I mean, like preach even harder, because but for the grace of God, I see many, many people choosing the whatever color, the blue pill over the red, whether they think they're going to or not. I hope I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong.
I agree. I think you're right. I think, but I'm not sure there's much we can do about that on a corporate scale. I think we could do
right.
preach the gospel on a and pluck individuals out of the fire by the grace of God. But you know, I think Anne, we were talking yesterday about some of these things, and she grew up in basically a pre-industrial revolution village. No water, no electricity, no running water, no electricity. No one had cars. You walked there. It was just basic, like you would have had in a village in, you know, 1800.
Her initial attraction to you is sounding much more plausible at this point. I understand this now. So she's like, oh, there he is.
So the point is that she, you know, everyone had to go to the well to get water in the morning, and you had to light your lamps to have light in the house. It was very basic. So, and then slowly, like, she grew up there, so slowly technology made its way in. And so first you had some electricity come in, and then the village moved closer to the road, so you had some access to a telephone, a landline. Now everyone has cell phones. People go in and out from Farkala to the nearest big town, Sikasso, all the time. And the way she described it is people she grew up with and families were stable, the culture was stable, became destabilized. Like, you have suddenly people are miserable. Suddenly people have depression. No one had depression before. Suddenly people are like contemplating leaving, breaking up their family. Just things that never would have happened in that family, in those family circles and those systems, are happening because there's no more friction. There's less friction in life than there had been before, and we're in a far farther advanced stage of that than they are. But once you start into the realm of technology, it seems like there's really no way it's going to keep continuing, and it's going to destroy our humanity unless we do what you're saying there, JD. I think.
Well, there is
maybe
one
I'm
way.
Too dire.
There is one way, and it's unfortunate that the Pope did not quote Joshua chapter 8 and verse 28 in his encyclical, which is that Joshua burned AI and made it forever a heap of ruins, as it is to this day. So we have a biblical injunction of how to handle AI. Just burn it to the ground and leave it a heap of ruins.
Yeah, that's great.
I mean, maybe bring it all full circle, but I've been reading a book recently I just discovered it by a guy named Zerbst, and it's about the marital analogy that permeates the Bible that he argues is the foundation for the reconciliation of the image of God in man and men and women. And I'm not finished with it yet, but it's affecting the way I'm thinking in a good way. But I do think that at the heart of this, and we see the breakdown, is that when the image of God, men and women, was when sin entered and rent that asunder, as it were, then the ramifications of that relational breakdown have generational realities through children, through systems, through all sorts of things. And then one of the points of resolution, reconciliation, and preaching for the church has, is, and will continue to be actual human interaction, in particular with the broken image, i.e. men and women, in whatever capacity that looks like, but most prominently in and through marriage and procreation, is that's going to be, continue to be one of our major sort of witnesses to the world. You know, it's like we won't be content with a robot wife, or won't be content with a cybernetic womb or something. Like, we won't be content with these things, not because they may be more pleasurable, but because they're not real and they're not true and they don't point to what is actually real and good and true. That's sort of what I've been taking from this, is that, you know, whatever AI tools are sort of beneficial in my life, you know, whatever it ends up being as a tool, I think and I trust that God will continue to ground and anchor his people by his spirit in what is true, which is not digital, but is actually embodied and enfleshed and ensouled. And that we will, I think, be pleasantly surprised at how not only secure and solid that foundation is in an ever-changing landscape, but also how attractive and evangelistic it will be to people who are, you know, have been or on the precipice of getting devoured by this new technology. I think we have ample resources and plenty of things to say, and so I'm sort of looking forward to it.
Well, way to bring it back from the edge there, JD, and end us on a positive note. Thank you. Thank you for that. That's going to be all the time we have today for the show. Thanks, as always, for listening to Stand Firm. If you want to keep the conversation going, be in touch with us. Rate and review the podcast on iTunes. Send us an email at mailbag@standfirminfaith.com or join the Anglicans for the Gospel Facebook group. Thanks to JD Koch and Matt Kennedy. I'm Nick Lannon, and Lord willing, we'll be back next week. Until then, by the grace of God and Jesus Christ, we'll be standing firm.